Welcome to the Ortho Joe Podcast, a joint production of the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery and Ortho Evidence. Join hosts Mohit Bhandari and Mark Swankowski as they discuss current topics and publications in the world of orthopedics and beyond.
Well, good morning, Mo.
Good morning, Mark. Good morning.
You I know have what, Mike? My Ortho Joe. I saw that earlier before
you
we
did.
Went live.
You did see, right?
And,
yes,
and
you
I,
did see.
I hope the trustees are not watching these and have found that you're.
But I always keep a trust. I always keep my cup with me. I do have it. It's just it's always there. But you know, in the rush of getting coffee, I just had to do it. But anyways,
yeah,
we have
well,
we
Tim
have,
Hortons
we
have, is great, mind you. I'm not disputing that Tim Hortons is okay. is an issue. It's the housing of the
it's
Tim
the
Hortons.
Housing. That's right. That's so, right. I got to be. I don't know. I mean, we have two guests here who will definitely, I'm sure, at some point towards the end of this conversation, shed light. But these cups stay warm for a long time. I don't know what they do, but these cups are really good that way.
Not as good as the Ortho Joe mug, which our guests
yeah,
will receive
yeah, true.
For participating in this podcast.
Right. So I'd like to, if I could, Mark, welcome two of our guests this morning to talk about an important paper, a paper that was the lead article in this month's Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery. The paper itself was titled Association Between Periprosthetic Joint Infraction and Mortality Following Primary Joint Arthroplasty, a very large population-based cohort study conducted in Canada and by two of our investigators. So the lead author for the paper, Raman Mundi, an assistant professor at the University of Toronto, an orthopedic surgeon, and the senior author of the paper was Bhishma Ravi, who's an associate professor as well and an orthopedic surgeon practicing at the University of Toronto. Welcome, gentlemen.
Mm-hmm. Thank you
for having us.
Can I just ask up front the origins? So how did you come up with this idea or what were the, I guess, circumstances that led you to want to explore this particular question?
Yeah, I can start. So once again, thanks, Mo. Thanks, Mark. Thanks for having us and giving us a chance to sort of discuss and highlight this paper. You know, I think we can all agree that prosthetic joint infections are one of the most unfortunate and devastating, if not the most devastating complication associated with joint replacement surgery. And I think it's been well proven that even if you achieve cure, that there's often sort of this chronic morbidity and functional decline that patients have after a prosthetic joint infection. But there's sort of growing evidence that maybe it's just not about morbidity, that it directly increases mortality risk as well. And we came across a few studies. There's some sort of hospital level single center studies, but more recently, some evidence from Europe, the Danish Hip Registry and the Swedish Hip Registry, which showed that maybe there is a direct increased risk of mortality. And, you know, those studies did have some limitations, like they included hip fracture patients, which we know inherently, even without infection, have about a 20 to 30% mortality rate at 1 year. So, you know, we thought that this sort of a good start, but we needed some more definitive evidence with a more robust sort of controlling for confounders. Because if we could show that there is, in fact, a definitive sort of link between infection, prosthetic joint, and mortality, that would have sort of significant implications, both clinically and from a research perspective.
Yes, yeah, from your perspective, then, what was the key finding, the message you want readers to take away?
I can speak to that, Raman, if that's okay. So I think our key finding is that although infection is rare after joint replacement, it is potentially has long-term effects. And although we didn't get into it in this study, I think we're going to build on it in future work. But if someone, God forbid, does get an infection, it's imperative that it's treated effectively and likely also treated quickly. So I think every surgeon can speak to having a patient where you're not sure if there's an infection. And in retrospect, you wonder if maybe the workup could have been done a bit faster, et cetera. So I think our work just suggests that if there is suspicion for infection, it needs to be worked up very aggressively and managed, you know, aggressively as well. So that hopefully is just one more treatment and then the patient is cured. And as opposed to letting it drag out and become a chronic issue that can then have an impact on a patient's lifespan.
And just for clarity, we're talking about a study which included over 175,000 participants. It was an observational study here. And you are looking specifically at patients who came in with an infection within that first year period. So if they get an infection within the first year after a total joint replacement, am I correct to suggest that there's a fivefold increase in mortality risk over a 10-year period?
Yes, that is what we found. And obviously there's an element of residual confounding because sicker patients with comorbidities tend to get infections, and those are also the people that in general would have a higher mortality. We tried matching for that, but even after that, I think it's fair to say there's always an element. You're limited with the cohort study retrospective, but with a five-fold effect, even if, say, twofold was dismissed because of residual confounding, still a large amount, but there's still an effect size and a signal there that suggests that infection by itself does increase mortality in the long term.
So if I could ask you two, what are the statistical approaches to do your very best to try to limit the confounding with the medical comorbidities? Just maybe educate our listeners a bit on that.
Sure. Raman, I can start if that's okay with you. So it's very challenging to control, obviously, for this. And I think it starts with having accurate data. So if you have a data resource that's been well-validated and lists comorbidities, then you could potentially either match for them. And I think right now a lot of people try matching or propensity score matching, or probably stronger is some sort of regression analysis where you sort of control for these. Matching is sometimes, I like matching because I'm simpler. And I think when you match and you can say these patients were matched for this and this, then the answer makes a bit more sense. But a regression is probably more powerful. But I think the more fundamental issue, though, is that the data you have needs to be accurate. So I think in this age of large database studies, we tend to take what's given at face value. So they say hypertension, but we don't know if that hypertension was uncontrolled or controlled, et cetera, et cetera. So having a validated definition is probably the greatest strength. And that's one of the advantages we have here. We use these databases in Ontario, Canada, that are really well validated because people have gone back and done chart reviews. So they've actually said, if it lists hypertension, this is the amount of hypertension this person had. So it gave us a lot more freedom than, say, NISQIP or something else, which is still very powerful. But here, a lot of the definitions are a bit better validated, allowing for better control.
And Bhishma, and I guess the same to you, Raman, here is, I mean, this particular question, really, there is no randomized trial you would ever conduct. It just, there wouldn't be a study. This study question is really to be answered with a large observational cohort study. So, but let me ask you this. If you were to think about a trial, not for this specific question, but let's say it was someone who gets an infection, aggressive treatment or treatment modalities and potential mortality risk, is that even feasible? I mean, given the fact that it's a couple of 100,000 patients here, will we ever see a trial done in this area with mortality as the outcome?
With mortality as the outcome. You know, I think there's certainly an opportunity to do trials in this sort of area, you know, sort of two broad categories. One is sort of prevention of infections. And then I think the other sort of category would be sort of our treatment strategies in terms of how we manage these infected patients, you know, namely antibiotic duration, perioperative strategies, single versus two-stage revisions. That's kind of a big question that remains looming. And I know there's some trials work going on in that. I think you can assess mortality through the trials, but I think it'd be very hard to do as the primary outcome. You know, as you can sort of see, when you have to follow patients out for 5-10 years, clinical trials become, I wouldn't say impractical, but they become subject to a lot of sort of lost follow-up and challenges. So I think you can assess those things, but I don't think these clinical trials necessarily would be powered or with mortality as being the primary outcome.
And do either of you have a sense of, you know, with mortality, so a patient comes in, they have, they get an infection, and then at some period in the next 5 years, you know, they die. Is there a mechanism by which, like, it's happening? Was there a particular type? Like, you know, like mortality encompasses a composite of many ways in which someone can pass. Was there any signal on that? Or do you have any exploration of or ideas of why that might be, what might be causing it?
We didn't explore that in great detail, but we do know these were mainly in-hospital deaths and not say from a car accident or something else. And one of our sub-analyses, which we didn't include in the final submission, but suggested that in terms of the comorbidities that were the biggest predictors and also suggested in-hospital death were things like liver dysfunction and renal dysfunction, which predisposed to an infection, but also predisposed to that infection being having an effect on mortality in the long run.
Excellent.
Yeah, I'm going to diverge a little bit from your data to just speak to you as clinicians working in this area. So I think most of the people listening to this are aware of the issue of colonization versus infection, and the studies that have shown that, you know, with retrieval of implants, that a large number of them, you can identify bacteria, et cetera. And the whole question of when does colonization become an infection? Do you think that the real issue here, given the fact that a fair number of prostheses have some glycocalyx protected sequestered bacteria, that it's the immune response of the individual that allows a colonization to become an infection? Therefore, the comorbidity is really the most important thing. I'm spouting out a little bit of my own bias on this, but I just wonder if you two think that this is crazy or what's real, what's going on?
I don't think it's crazy at all. I think obviously individuals' health and their overall nutritional status, how they take care of themselves, et cetera, modulates their immune response and modulates their effect or their response to our treatments. Joint replacement, fracture, anything really. It's you know, it's a large part is dictated by the patient factors that we can't control. But it goes back to as surgeons, then we need to modify the things that we can control. We can't really control these patient factors, but we can control potentially other factors in terms of steps we can take to minimize infection. And God forbid, if next infection does happen, to then manage it. But I think you're definitely onto something, and that's likely the future of our field, or one component of it, which is improving patient nutrition and other patient factors that may mitigate these outcomes.
Mark, I agree as well. Like, you know, if you look at sort of studies that have, you know, even randomized control trials that have sometimes looked at sort of wound swabs as a kind of as a surrogate for infection, just because it's easier data to collect, you know, there's a large number of patients that end up having positive sort of cultures from these wound swabs at the end of the surgery. And so, and that's without sort of any sort of intraoperative contamination event. And so I do think, you know, it's almost it's impossible to completely eliminate patients from having any sort of intraoperative bacterial growth into the wound. So I think these sort of patient factors that compromise immune status and predispose them to sort of developing a full sort of prosthetic joint infection are sort of possible important targets, as Bishma has suggested.
It's always a good day when an old investigator gets some reinforcement from young active investigators. And this really does fit into the whole wave of microbiome research that is across all surgical fields. So thanks for the reinforcement. Made my day.
So on that topic,
someone's called me young in a while, so that's good.
What's next, gentlemen? What is next for you in this, in this program of research? Are you exploring more? And what can we at the Journal of Bone and Joint Surgery anxiously await as the next contribution to the literature?
I mean, Raman and I have thought about this a great deal, because when we first saw the effect and we thought back on, you know, obviously, as every surgeon has a patient that gets infected, we became profoundly depressed as we sort of think, dear God, you know, have I contributed to this patient's long-term mortality? Mm-hmm. And I think what has assuaged us somewhat is a lot of our work so far has sort of demonstrated the importance of volume, so surgeon volume, on lowering the risk for complications. You know, the more you do something, the more reflective you are on your outcomes, the more likely you are to reduce complications. And our own feeling is that, and we're currently working on this, is looking at that effect on revisions. There's been so much work on primaries. And we also think that the next part of this will be on these patients that do get an infection, is there a role for involving even higher level subspecialty, maybe a surgeon that specializes in infections, or a surgeon that has really a good track record of dealing with infections to help you with that procedure? Does that have an effect? Because it may be that infections do happen and they're rare, but perhaps the next step is showing that really effective treatment early on is what can halt the mortality effect. So that's sort of a long-winded explanation of what we're looking at next. Raman, did I miss anything?
No, I don't think so. If I can just quickly, you know, add to that, you know, I kind of look at this as two broad sort of, you know, I mentioned it before, is prevention and treatment. And, you know, I think sort of prevention is always, you know, like ideal. And, you know, I think that sometimes we think that with the so-called 0.5 or 1% infection risk prosthetic joint infection, some people say, well, that just by random chance alone, that can't get any better. But what we have to remember is not all arthroplasty patients have an equal risk. You know, I think we've gotten into sort of an era where we're more inclusive in terms of the patients we're operating on. You know, there's kind of getting away with BMI cutoffs, younger patients, patients with more comorbidities, and certain subgroups of patients have higher risks of infection, whether it be sort of 3%, 4%, 5%. And I think those are the patients where we have to say, like, how can we, what strategies can we use to prevent infection in these patients? And, you know, if you sort of search of the clinicaltrials.gov, and in Canada alone, just in Ontario and Quebec, there's four active clinical trials that are multi-centered looking at sort of infection prevention arthroplasty patients. So I think that just speaks to sort of, you know, this is not something that's new. It's not novel. It's not robotics. This is sort of, infections have been there since we started doing joint replacements, and yet there's still sort of this ongoing interest to improve infection rates. And then the second category is treatment. You know, I kind of compare this to hip fractures. We know that treatment makes a difference in mortality risk. You know, the timing of surgery makes a difference. There may be something left to uncover here in terms of improving mortality risk, whether, you know, there's some evidence that maybe single stage actually decreases mortality risk compared to two stage revisions, suggesting that everyone start doing single stage revisions. It's just early observational data, but I think we need to build on those things. And as Dr. Rabi said, maybe timing to surgery, ability to diagnose these patients quicker and get them cured faster, you know, can make this less of a chronic disease and really influence mortality rates. So I think sort of two broad categories is what sort of we need to prioritize.
Yeah, I mean, I would just simply add that, you know, keep at it, because it's, you know, the argument, you know, for, oh, it's a relatively rare outcome, and therefore we're not likely to move the dial, is, well, if they use the same mindset in MIs, which are, you know, 1 to 1.5% mortality, they've got that down to 0.75, 0.3, you know, whatever. And that's been through absolute large teams working together and, you know, coming together globally with a question that matters to everyone, right? When you have an outcome like infection or mortality that matters, you will have, you know, you'll have everyone listening, whether they're here in Africa, in India, China, you know, throughout Europe or North America. So congratulations to both of you for continuing this work. And, you know, we wish you all the best as you move forward. And we look forward again to learning more and continuing to, you know, see the work that's coming up from your group. Thank you so much. And I hope you have a good rest of your day.
Thank you, Mel. Thank you, Mark.
Yeah, you're welcome.